Welcome to The Roundup, where we tackle big health topics from the outback to the tropics. I'm your host, Alyssa Hatherley, a local GP and head of James Cook University's Clinical School in Mackay. In each episode, you'll hear from experienced clinicians sharing expert insights on key regional health issues, best practice approaches, and practical strategies to improve patient care in regional and rural settings. Before we begin, I'd like to respectfully acknowledge the Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, their contributions to healthcare, and the traditional owners of the lands in which we practice and provide education. In today's episode, I'm joined by Hannah Mason, who's originally from Canada, but working here in the public health space in North Queensland. Hi, Hannah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
How did you come to be in North Queensland?
Oh, well, it's actually interesting, the journey. I kind of, you know, I started in the space of nutrition and food science, and I kind of wanted to veer away from that a little bit and started to look into public health. But I also was pretty keen on kind of management and how we're managing our health systems. And then it just started with as everything kind of does, a Google to see what would kind of come up. And I found this program at JCU that was pretty highly regarded, which was a dual master's of business administration and public health. And I gave my mom a call and I said, "Mom, I think I'm going to Australia." And I found myself here. I truly didn't really know anything about Townsville. I thought, you know, my Canadian brain thinks that north is going to be cooler, which of course we're on the opposite side of the equator. So no, and suddenly I was in this tropical environment learning about public health. So it was quite interesting, the transition.
That's a big leap, isn't it? And now your teaching and your research is mainly into how climate change and heat is impacting our health, isn't it?
Yeah, our health and also our health services, of course, you know, just as similar as it is to Canada, we've got these challenges in our health services, our hospitals, our EDs, our ambulances, and all these extra pressures going on. And then we kind of think about, well, we're also under this pressure of a changing climate. So how do all of those things kind of come together and impact the way we work and also our personal health as well?
Now, whilst we chat, it's the end of summer here in North Queensland. We are all well and truly tired of the heat, the endless heat, and at the moment some rain as well. Can we talk a little bit about the things that doctors should be watching out for in our patients in the first instance?
Sure. Well, you know, it's quite complex when we think about disasters and climate-induced disasters and how they kind of fall. Sometimes you have disasters that kind of happen on their own. So, you know, we have a flood and we're dealing particularly with flood impacts. And, you know, we've seen recently in the news things about melioidosis. And so there's all of that kind of stuff when there's an individual disaster. But we're also seeing kind of an increase in these compounding and cascading disasters. So, you know, we have a cyclone and then we have some flooding and then we have a heat wave while we're trying to clean up all of the water. So, and then of course that introduces things like mold. So it's very specific to the disaster and what the hazards are kind of happening around the disaster. And then of course, just knowing who is most vulnerable to that type of disaster, right? So we might think of, you know, young children, older adults, people who don't have access to care are kind of our typical people that we're thinking that we really need to pay some close attention to. But then we have other groups like refugees, for an example, that may need different languages to understand kind of what their risk is and what the hazard is and how to stay safe. So I think, yeah, it's a really loaded question. Who do we have to pay attention to, right? It depends on the disaster and it depends on individual vulnerability. But I think at the end of the day, it's a kind of a combined effort to make sure we have everyone's back.
It's a massive, massive issue. Holy cow, Hannah, where are we going to start?
Well, I think that we kind of start thinking about, okay, well, what are the disasters that we're seeing happening more frequently? And this is kind of an interesting space because we have the intersection of, medicine. We have the intersection of public health, which of course in public health we're thinking a little bit more broadly about, control and vulnerability and hazards, promoting health behaviors, which I mean, public health and medicine definitely very closely intersect. And then we also have climate science, which I think a lot of us that work in the health space have, a pretty minimal understanding of climate science. So we have to bring a lot of different people kind of to the table. And for us here at JCU in public health and tropical medicine, we've been focusing a lot on heat waves because heat waves are a really interesting type of disaster, right? It's not like a cyclone or a bushfire that kind of rips through the town and we see it, we feel it, we can see, the disaster it's kind of left behind. Heat waves can kind of creep up on us and kind of, sinks its fingers into everything. And then it might take a little bit of time for the effects of that heat wave to actually be clearly identified. So for me personally, my interest is in this kind of heat wave space, especially here in Queensland, where we have such a range of climate zones, and how someone experiences a heat wave down on the Gold Coast is completely separate to a heat wave up in Cairns, for example, and that's true for across Australia. I mean, Australia is just such a diverse landscape. So in terms of where do we go, I think it depends on who you're talking to, but if you're talking to me today, then we probably end up in heat waves is where we're kind of starting.
Now, to me, heat wave is just a synonym for a pretty normal summer. How do we define a heat wave?
That's a great question. So heat waves currently are defined by the Bureau of Meteorology. They are the ones that, you turn on your TV or your radio and they say, hello, we are in a heat wave. And there's some different severities. So there's a low intensity, a severe, and an extreme heat wave. So extreme heat waves are known to be, quite rare, low intensity, more common. How they determine if it's a heat wave is actually a pretty complicated formula. It takes into account the local temperature, historical temperature, the last 3 days, the last 90 days, a reference period, which, predates the 2000s, which we compare to. So there's all these kind of things that are going into this metric. But essentially, if the Bureau of Meteorology is saying that you are in heat wave conditions, that's actually localized to where you are living in Australia, which is different from other countries, right? In Canada, we might say, oh, if it's over 35 degrees for 3 days, you're in a heat wave. Well, in Townsville, that might almost be all summer. So yeah. We have these very specific ways of defining heat and heat waves here in Australia.
So from a public health perspective, when we are in heatwave conditions, we need to think about our patients' health and the healthcare services. What are the things that we need to be looking out for?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about health services, we've looked into, okay, what's the impact on ambulance calls? So kind of, the first touch point potentially into the health system, you give a call to the ambulance and say, so-and-so is not well or I'm unwell. And we're seeing that those calls are going up by about 13% in Queensland. So it's actually quite significantly. If you can think of how many, ambulance call takers you need on a hot day, you need, 13% more of that kind of capacity to be able to answer those calls. So we have kind of that going on. And then it relaxes a little bit when we come to the actual ambulance presentations. When the ambulance actually arrives at the scene, we're seeing about a 10% increase. And then we go to hospital admissions are increased by about 9%, and deaths by about 5%. So we can kind of see that, the kind of immediate touch point of care in ambulances is kind of the most impacted. And we can think about, oh my goodness, well, we've already got all of these ambulance problems, don't we, with ambulance ramping and demand. And so I think from a health systems perspective, we have to think about, how do we reduce that load? What are our kind of, how are we messaging the public and telling them about their risk? Do you actually know your own risk factors to heat. So there are certain medical conditions, right, that make you more vulnerable to heat. And do I know that about myself? Do I know anything about my age? Do I know anything about, you know, my socioeconomic status? Even my social kind of surroundings can impact my vulnerability to heat. So we think about kind of all of those things and how we're giving that message, because at the end of the day, I mean, we want to reduce this kind of need to access the healthcare system in the first place. But I think that a good touch point is the conversations that are happening between patients and their GPs, right? Especially for older patients who we identify as a group that are definitely more impacted by extreme heat. So are they able to have conversations with their healthcare teams about how they keep themselves cool? And that's also specific to where they live, right? If you're dealing, like I said earlier, I mean, Australia has a lot of different climate zones. So if you're someone who lives in a high humidity environment, using something like an evaporative cooler is not going to help you, because there's already such a high vapor pressure. Versus if you live in a cool, dry climate, you know, maybe that's what you need. So yeah, it's really specific, it's really localized. And I think it starts at everybody understanding what their risk is and how they can kind of mitigate that risk.
So for the doctors in the community, the most important thing is to be having that conversation with all of our patients. So the elderly, you mentioned, patients with lots of comorbidities on lots of medications, the effect of dehydration and the risk of acute kidney injury for some of those patients is really high.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I think it's, we've all felt the heat before, you know, it kind of makes you feel sluggish. And, you know, the last thing you kind of want to do is get out and about and, you know, maybe see the doctor. But that might actually be like the crucial point where you potentially need to. And yeah, like you said, that, I mean, medications is another factor. How is that impacting your body's ability to regulate the heat? And I mean, a lot of us, the solution is usually flick on the air con, right? And on kind of a bigger level, not just the medical and public health kind of level, but, you know, what happens if there's a heat wave that's so extreme that it impacts the power grid, which certainly happens. We've seen happen frequently, especially in the United States. We see that the power shuts off. So if all of our kind of strategies are, oh, well, we flick on the air con and then suddenly it's cool and we're fine, we just stay inside all day. You know, what happens if that doesn't work, or what happens if we're in a place that doesn't have the same kind of air con capabilities? How do we keep ourselves cool is a really important question.
We need to think about that heat in terms of risk for our environment too, more broadly, don't we, Hannah? So the marine stinger exposure is going to be heading further south, impacting those big tourist areas too. Are crocs going south? Are those arboviruses moving further south too? The dengues, the Ross Rivers? Are we going to be seeing more malaria cases locally?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that there's potentially areas that have, you know, pretty good understanding of the typical risks in that community. And those risks are now changing with climate change. I mean, we're seeing that heat waves specifically are growing in not only just, you know, how intense they are, but how large they are. So how much area they cover and how frequently they're occurring as well. I mean, the modeling for Queensland specifically is, you know, expecting a large number of days under heat wave conditions by the end of the century in the absence of climate change mitigation. So you're right, that impacts everything. I mean, we think about the kind of One Health approach in, you know, human and animals and how that all interacts. And certainly we're not the only ones impacted. And then, you know, that feeds back into human health. So it's very interesting. And there's so many sectors that are interested in how this is going to impact. We even did a little bit of work in sporting and sport med, which was really interesting with the Brisbane Olympics in 2032 and how we're going to prepare for that. And you're right, you have to think about everything, right? What are the hazards that are going to happen there, and what kind of medical staff do we need for that event? And what, you know, it's happening in Brisbane winter, but we also know that there's certain events that are happening happening up in Cairns and happening here in Townsville. So, you know, our athletes and viewers that are coming from abroad, are they used to those kind of risks? So it's very challenging.
Anna, goodness me, you've brought up a lot of potential problems. What are some of the potential solutions that we can be enacting now?
That's a great question. I think that the leadership of this has to come from our health authorities, and that we're starting to see that happen, which is great. Queensland Health, for example, is bringing out a lot of policy, a lot of information about how we can protect ourselves. And there needs to be an awareness. I think that, you know, we might downplay the impact of heat frequently, where we say, oh, you know, especially if we're young and we're, you know, oh, well, it's just a low intensity heat wave. Maybe I go outside and garden or go play soccer or whatever you want to do that day, and potentially don't really recognize the dangers that we might be kind of playing with there. So I think that the solutions, I mean, firstly, we need our health systems to take heat seriously, which I think is starting to happen, which is great to see some changes at the policy level. I think we need to make sure that, you know, as doctors and nurses and allied health professionals, that we know how to advise people to cope with the heat when it's hot. So things like fans, right? We see everybody flick on the fan, and that's great. And that could be used really well in conjunction with air conditioning, but that doesn't actually cool your space, right? Or we think about things like, you know, being in a cold shower and how that impacts the body and how we can kind of cool down in those mechanisms. And, you know, being aware of where the cool spaces of refuge are in your community. Do you have kind of a library you can go hang out that day, or, you know, potentially go watch a movie or something? So there's all of these things about, you know, how do we protect ourselves? How do we communicate to patients and clients about how they can cool themselves down? And then as just a person who needs to access the healthcare system and, you know, has my own health concerns, what are the things that I need to know about myself that might make me more susceptible to heat? And how can I kind of prevent that from happening, you know, a worst case scenario? So I think, yeah, I think it's a good point of education. And I think we're kind of getting there. We're getting these messages out, which is important. And now we can kind of start to take it more seriously and think into the future how we really protect ourselves.
That is so fascinating, Hannah. Now, public health is a massive, massive subject. What are some of the other public health matters that people may not be aware of?
Oh, great question. I mean, there's so much in public health. We kind of think about, you know, epidemiology, which is the flow and, you know, way that disease kind of disseminates in our population. So we think about those kind of things, and we've got our biostatistics, and that's kind of, you know, figuring out what treatments work, what treatments don't work. So that's kind of a massive part of what we do. But then we also have, you know, the One Health, like we talked about before, and this kind of interaction between humans and our environment and animals, and how that actually really impacts our health and well-being. We think about things like the determinants of health, which is, you know, so central to health promotion. And of course, we think about our most vulnerable kind of populations and how we can ensure that they are able to receive adequate and timely healthcare, and if they're, you know, how they're going with their health literacy and, you know, knowing how to take care of themselves, and us learning how we need to take care of vulnerable groups that maybe we don't fully understand. So, I mean, there's so much going on in public health. I think it's, you know, just in our team here at JCU, we've got, you know, just, I'm thinking just in my kind of area, I've got across from me epidemiologist who is exploring TB and HIV. And then beside the epidemiologist is someone from Ghana who has explored health policy for people living with disability in terms of their sexual health. So we've got sexual health in there. And then, you know, upstairs, we've got Chris McBain-Rigg, who is really into Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's health and how we can interact. And it's just so, so broad, I think. It's another big question.
And then in terms of boots on the ground, public health, it's broader than delivering a comprehensive community vaccination policy or contact tracing for syphilis cases, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah, we have, I mean, a public health unit here in Townsville. We do up in Cairns and in many different places around Australia. And there's a lot of projects that are going on, not just in terms of, kind of the more recognizable things like vaccinations, but also, safety and, environmental things like smoking and water quality and air quality. And, it really is a massive field. And we are lucky to have so many diverse professionals that are public health people and that are a part of this public health conversation. We've got, like I said before, we've got allied health professionals, we have dentists, we have doctors, we have such a nurses, such a range of people, and including people who are, policy practitioners who are a part of the conversation. So it's a really interesting field, and it's ever changing with, the new kind of hazards and the new things that are going on across the whole world, really.
Wow, Hannah, now what would be your top tips or your take-home message for our listeners today in terms of public health?
Good question. I think stay on top of things, I think is kind of, public health things are often in the media, so just knowing what's going on. We're seeing, like I just said, these outbreaks in Meliadosis following the floods. So, maybe that triggers me to think, maybe I should, brush up a little bit on that and what the signs are. Or, if we know that there's something coming, a cyclone, then maybe I'm starting to think like, okay, what advice am I giving around disaster ready kits? And, am I preaching to the choir, or do I actually have one myself? And is my facility prepared? So I think, brushing up on what's going on is obviously really important. And then, get involved with public health. I think there's a lot of people who are coming into the public health space who are taking diplomas and masters and kind of learning everything that public health has to offer. And I think that that's great. I think that bringing a public health approach into the way that we practice medicine, physio, OT, speech. I mean, whether you really recognize it's there or it's not, I mean, public health is there, right? So I think learning more about it is kind of a great tool for us to think about how the whole system is working.
How fascinating. Dr. Hannah Mason, public health practitioner, also with an MBA. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
For more information about the Roundup or to share your feedback and ideas for future episodes, visit nqrth.edu.au/roundup-podcast or contact us at nqrth.mackay@jcu.edu.au. We also want to advise that the views and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the speaker only and do not represent the views and opinions of James Cook University, Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs, or Queensland Health. The content supplied in this podcast is not intended as medical advice and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs is an initiative of the Australian Government's Integrated Rural Training Pipeline and is facilitated by James Cook University in partnership with public and private hospitals, Queensland Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, health services, Aboriginal community controlled health organisations, and general practice clinics.